Thank you, Ignacio. So, as Ignacio mentioned, I will talk about symmetry and optimization, a topic on which I worked for, the last 10 years, on and off, of course. And this is a problem. So, first slide, symmetry and optimization. You have a very generic problem, minimization of a function f of x that can be arbitrary. You have arbitrary constraints g of x more equals to 0. And here we will assume that you have a certain subset of the variable that must be integer. So it's one of the most generic problems that you can think of. And you have no constraint on f, no constraints on g, could be anything. Now, there are some of these problems that are called symmetric. So you all know what a permutation is. So here you look at the permutation of the variable. In total, you have n variable in this problem, and you just take a permutation of the indices of these variables. So pi will be a permutation. It applies, we write pi of x1, xn, but in fact we are just permuting the indices of these variables. Like we just permute the variables. And you say that pi is a symmetry of the problem if you have two properties. The first one is if x is feasible, then its permutation pi of x is also feasible if and only if. And secondly, the value of f of x and f of pi of x are identical. So in other words, if you have a permutation like this, it doesn't matter if you give me x or pi of x. For me, both solutions have exactly the same value, and both are feasible or both are infeasible. Right, so among all the solutions for which satisfying these two property, if I just find one optimal solution, let's say if x is an optimal solution of the problem, then pi of x will also be an optimal solution of the problem. And if you have many permutations that gives you different solutions, then you have a problem that has many optimal solutions, and it will be difficult to deal with these by just doing branch and bound. Although this first slide applies to a generic mixed integer nonlinear program, just to illustrate the ideas of these how we can handle symmetries, I will look at the special case of the integer linear programming. So here you assume all of the functions are linear. C is a vector, A is a matrix, B is a vector, and here you also assume that all the variables are bounded between 0 and k, and they must all be integer. So it's a very specific problem, but it's much easier to illustrate the ideas. All the ideas that are used for this, that will be presented regarding solving a symmetric integer linear program, you can translate them easily in the nonlinear case, or in the case where you have not all variables that should be integer. It just adds a level of complexity. And for this talk, I just want to do something relatively high level. And so if you understand the ideas that applies to integer linear programming, you should be able to figure out how to extend these ideas for the nonlinear case. Although it's much more difficult and there is much less work that has been done for using symmetry when solving nonlinear problems. Most of the effort has been done so far using mixed integer or integer linear programming. I just know of a couple of papers who are really dealing with nonlinear problem using the same type of techniques, and they get the same type of improvement in the solution time. All right, so we say that similarly to what we did before, right? Pi is a symmetry of the ILP. If x feasible, if and only if pi of x is feasible. And both solutions, x and pi of x, have exactly the same optimal value. Just to give you a very concrete example, if we look at this small example with four variables, so all of them must be binary. Of course, when you just look at the formulation, you see that these three variables, x1, x2, x3, are essentially the same. Right? If you permute any of the three, you take any permutation of the three first variable, you can find a permutation of the rows that gives you exactly the same matrix here. But the fourth variable is quite different. So you can see that the feasible solution for this problem are Well, you just have a, either you decide, if you select x4, so x4 equals 1, then you have no choice. All the other variables should be 0. On the other hand, if x4 is 0, you can pick anything here. You can pick either 0 of them, 1 of them, 2 of them, all 3 of them. This is all feasible. So your feasible solutions are these 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 vectors. And you can check that the set of all symmetries of the IMP is exactly all the permutation of the first three indices, and keeping always the index 4 last in the permutation. Right? The image of x4 is different from the other three variables. You can take any permutation of the first three, and you get a permutation of the feasible set of the IMP. All right, so of course, if you take G with the...
Can you say next slide?
Oh, sorry. I'm on the slide, the symmetry group. So if you take G with the composition of permutation is a group. Right? So if you do permutation pi 1 and then permutation pi 2, that you compose the two permutations. And of course, if I add pi 1, that is a permutation of the symmetry group of the problem, if I permute first the variable according to pi 1 and then according to pi 2, I still get a permutation of the problem. So we are dealing with a group. Definition of a group, if you don't remember, it will not be extremely important for this talk, right? But so if you compose permutation in G, you stay in G. G has a neutral element that is the identity permutation. And if you have a permutation in the group, there exists an inverse that do the inverse permutation. Now, example of a symmetric integer linear program are... You probably know coloring problem. If you have a graph and you try to color the vertices so that any two vertices receive that are adjacent receive distinct colors, you can try also to color the edges of the graph so that if you have two edges that share one endpoint, they should receive different colors. These problems are symmetric. They can be symmetric because the graph itself is symmetric, or because you have the symmetry between the colors. And when you solve this using standard formulation for ILP, for graph coloring, you will run into problems. Right? This is not efficient. Usually when people solve coloring problems, they are not using integer linear programming. They are using other techniques. Similarly, network design, when you have a symmetric network and you try to ask questions in the form, you know, I need to add capacity in the network so that certain points are connected. If you have a symmetry in the formulation of this problem, you get a symmetric ILP. You have each time you deal with flexible manufacturing operations and you have identical machine that can do exactly the same work, you just have to dispatch job on the machines, you have a problem that has symmetries. You can permute the machine between themselves. You have the design of statistical experiment. Well, that's a problem on which I worked quite a lot. It's not really... I mean, it's important for statisticians, and there are many pure combinatorial problems that are inherently symmetric. So when you deal with statistics or with combinatorics, there are many problems for which you can write an ILP formulation, and this formulation will be highly symmetric. And also, you probably know the Steiner tree problem. Right, you have a graph, you have a given set of points that you want to connect with a tree. And you want the cheapest tree to connect these points. This is the Steiner tree problem. This is an NP-complete problem. But there are solvers that are based on integer linear programming that are very efficient for solving this type of problem. And the only problems for which the solver have trouble have been constructed, in fact, by taking something that is highly symmetric. So you have an instance of the problem where the graph is highly symmetric, the points that you select to connect have also a symmetry, and then you just tweak slightly this problem. So in fact, it is not symmetric, right? But you start from a symmetric problem, and you just make very small modification to it to destroy the symmetry, and then you try to solve this. These are the only instances that are really difficult for these ILP solvers. So this is also a way to generate problems that are difficult for solvers. They you can of course keep the problem with the symmetry, or sometimes you can just destroy the symmetry, but the problem remains difficult to solve for your solver. Oops, sorry. So the slide, the branch and bound for ILP. You all know what branch and bound is, I suppose. Right? Here, if I have just an integer linear program with binary variables, you will branch on a variable saying, here, I chose at the root node to select in one branch x1 equals 1 or x1 equals 0. And here on the second branch, I had x2 equals 0 on the left and x1 equals 1 on the right. Now, if you assume that x1 and x2 are symmetric variable in this problem, then, of course, if I fix x1 to 1 and x2 equal to 0, or x1 to 0 and x2 equal to 1, I get the same problem, right? These two fixing are identical. And if I start just using straight branch and bound, I will have to enumerate a subtree, the red subtree on the left here, or the red subtree on the right here, and these two trees will be completely isomorphic. Right? And you are just multiplying your work. If you don't recognize that you have this symmetry, then you will just multiply the work that your solver has to do to get the optimal solution, because you have to, both subtrees here, the red one, must be enumerated if you are not able to realize that these two problems are, in fact, the same. So the problem is, it's not only a weakness of branch and bound, but, you know, when you have a problem like this that is symmetric and you use almost any solution technique, you will run into problems if you don't take advantage of the fact that you know that there is symmetry. If you forget about the symmetry, you are bound to maybe it will not be exactly in this form, but of course, if you have, you know, you have different way to look at the problem and you get the same type of solutions, you can expect that if you are able take this information into account when you solve the problem, you will get something that is much faster. Right. But the question is, how can I identify that these two problems are identical and I just need to solve one of them to find the optimal solution? Now, just to give you a taste, on the slide of problem characteristics, so I just listed about 10 problems that I used as benchmark problem. These are just pure integer linear program, so all the variables must take value between 0, I mean, all between 0 and 10, let's say. Some of them are binary, but you can see that these problems have relatively a small number of variables, right? The largest one has 1024 variables. That's not huge. I mean, if you ask Cplex, Express, or an efficient ILP solver, normally you would expect, if I give them a problem with a few hundred variables, I wait maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Most of these problems are solved. So here you have problems that are relatively small, right? This one is just 81 variable, STS 81. Also, the integrality gap is not big. So z hat here is the value of the optimal solution for the problem. When you have a dash, it means the problem is, in fact, infeasible. And LP gives you the value of the LP relaxation for this problem. So you see, for CA7, you get a gap of just 1, or a gap of 4. But, you know, these gaps are just 4-5%. Maybe the largest one is for code 9.3, where you get something that is roughly a 20% gap. So this one, you could say the gap is large. But for these, you know, most of them, the gap is relatively small. So you have a small number of variables, a relatively small gap. You would expect that an efficient solver will be able to solve them. But the symmetry group, so group order here, is the size of the symmetry group of the instance. So you see that for STS81, which has just 81 variables, you get something like 1 billion permutations in the group. Right, so you might expect that if you forget about the permutation, you will run into problem if you try to solve this. And you see here, using a commercial solver, I will not name it because they are not.
Well, no, it's
you can see that if you just use the defaults, most of these problems are not solved in 4 hours of computation time. And the just the first one is solved in 45 minutes. And by using techniques that take advantage of the symmetry of the problem, you can solve most of this problem in, I would say, 5 minutes. Let's say less than 5 minutes. So the difference between using symmetry and not using symmetry is not 10%. You don't get something that goes 10% faster. It's order of magnitude. When it works, it's order of magnitude. Of course, there are still problems that are not you are not able to handle, even if you take symmetry into account. But in many cases, you can reduce the running time of these problems by, let's say, 100, a factor of 100 most of the time. All right. So here, all this is based on this idea of I need the symmetric group of the feasible set. And you can say, well, okay, that's a nice mathematical concept. How do I get this group? Right, because in particular, if you have a problem that is infeasible, right, it has no feasible solution. If you look at the definition, the symmetric group for this is the full group. But of course, if I'm able to realize that the symmetric group of the feasible set is all the permutation, then I already solved the problem, right? I wouldn't need to solve the problem. So, of course, getting the correct group, so finding what is the group of the feasible set, is itself a difficult problem. So the symmetry, detecting symmetry in ILP, is the symmetry is a property of the feasible set, and when it is empty, it should be the full symmetric group. So in general, you are not able to compute it, but you can use any subgroup of the true group. So each time you identify one permutation that you can prove is a feasible permutation, so for example, if you have a production problem with 10 machines that are identical, you know that you can permute these 10 machines. This is a bunch of permutations that you know exist in your problem. You can use just that group. Even if the true group is much larger than this, everything you do by using this subgroup will be correct. You will just missing a few symmetries that possibly exist, but you can consider this subgroup as the group you will be working with. So getting the exact symmetric group of the ILP is difficult, but since you can work with any subgroup and get sensible gain, you can just start usually from the LP formulation of your problem, and you can analyze this LP formulation and find permutations. So you are sure that all the permutations you list are permutations of the feasible set, but you are not sure that you are getting all the permutations from the feasible set. Of course, you can easily construct counterexample if you look at the LP formulation. So you just look at the matrix AX equals B, and you analyze which permutation of the column of this matrix and which permutation of the rows of this matrix give me the same matrix again. You can easily destroy this, right? You can add more or less redundant inequalities that destroy completely the symmetry. So if you use your analyzer, you will say, well, this problem has no symmetries, where in fact the feasible set has a lot of symmetries. So you can, of course, get something that is very bad, but most of the time when you formulate the model yourself, you know that there are a bunch of symmetries, right? Typically, like I said, a bunch of machines that are identical in your problem, you know you can permute these machines in any solution. So for generating G, usually it is known from the model. Right? Even if, as I said, even if it's not the full group, you can just use whatever group you know is feasible. You can compute it from formulation. You can reformulate this as a graph automorphism problem. And you have, a graph automorphism is one of these problems that is well known as being, just at the border between P and NP. Nobody knows if it's an NP complete problem or a problem that is in P. You have very fast algorithms that solve them in practice, but in theory, nobody can bound the complexity of this algorithm by a polynomial in the size of the problem. But in practice, you can solve graph automorphism problem for graphs with easily 5,000 nodes in a few seconds. So usually you work with a subgroup, so you will be happy just to find a subgroup of the symmetry group of the feasible set and work with that one. Okay. Yes. Oh yeah. So general setting and problems. Here we are interested in solving problems for an arbitrary symmetry group. Right, so we want algorithm that can handle any kind of symmetry, not just the complete symmetry group. Of course, this is an area. I mean, there are many problems where your symmetric group is just a Cartesian product of complete symmetric groups. So you have machines that you can permute, you have jobs that are identical, and so you have small complete permutation groups on these items, and you can if you code really these things, you can take advantage from the fact that you know this is just a very simple group. I have all the permutation of this subset. So if you have a problem of this type, you can use the same idea as the one I present here, but you can implement them more efficiently if you are sure that the only group you are interested in is just complete permutation of subsets of your variables. We want also be able to handle general integer variables and not just binary variables. It doesn't change much in the presentation. And you have different problem that sometimes you are interested in. Depending on what you do, you might just be interested in finding the optimal solution and proving that it is optimal, or you just know already a solution and you just want to prove that it is optimal. Or in some problem, you need to find all the non-isomorphic solutions. Right? Because in particular, in the application where I work with people in statistics, they are interested in certain matrices that have properties. And given one of these matrix, they can compute a certain quality for that particular matrix that is a very, you know, it's a function that is highly non-convex, non-linear. And so you really need to see the matrix to be able to compute what is the quality of this matrix. And of course, among all solutions, they are just in each isomorphism class, you just need one of these matrices. If you start enumerating all solutions, you get millions and millions of matrices, and then you have to recognize all these matrices are in fact the same, and then you have to figure out which one are not non-isomorphic. So this is an area where, you have cases where you want to enumerate all non-isomorphic solutions of this problem. And you have a bunch of approaches that I will go over in this talk.
If you just say next slide.
Next slide, okay, sorry. So you have exact algorithm, and you have, one natural idea is just using perturbation. You say, okay, I have a problem that is symmetric. Symmetry is a problem. Why don't I get rid of it by just adding a permutation, perturbation, right? Perturbation of the cost function, for example. Then my problem is not symmetric anymore. You can use reformulations. So you have reformulation that lessen the burden of the symmetry in the problem. But this is very problem specific. It's not easy to do something that is typical. And one typical application is colon generation. Another natural idea is adding inequalities to your problem that break the symmetry. Right. You say, well, I know that if I add this inequality, there is at least one optimal solution that is left in my problem. So I can just add this inequality to my problem. And you can select a bunch of inequality like this, provided you are able to prove that once I add all these inequalities, there is at least one optimal solution left. Of course, you can solve this smaller problem. You have symmetry breaking during search. So here you will have, you develop a branch and bound algorithm. You remember what you have done so far, and you use the information that you have gained during the enumeration for adding new cuts to the nodes that you are solving right now. So it's a really dynamic way of solving this. You will use a branch and bound, and you remember what you have done and add inequalities to the current problem because you already have explored a certain part of the tree. And finally, the last one is pruning the enumeration tree. So it's really realizing that you have two nodes in the tree that are solving the same problem, and you will just prune one of the two. You say, I just need to solve that one and not this one. There are also approximate algorithm, orbital branching, and dominance relation. I will go over these relatively quickly. Okay, next slide. The first idea is modifying the objective function. So you add a small perturbation of the cos function, for example, in order to destroy symmetry. Of course, this helps when you just try to find, for example, a good solution. Because you will, when you apply a heuristic, it might help you to concentrate in a small part of the feasible set. So when you add this perturbation of the cos function, instead of jumping around your symmetric feasible set, you just explore carefully one small area of the feasible set. So this might be helpful when you just want to find quickly a good solution. But if you really want to prove infeasibility, it doesn't help you, because you destroy the symmetry that could be used, if you are clever, for proving optimality. So you destroy it, and then essentially you have to explore the same feasible set. And the problem, of course, when you solve the problem and you want to find the optimal solution, once you have found the optimal solution, let's say you have a heuristic, spits out the optimal solution, what is left to be done is proving this this solution is optimal. In other words, proving that there is no solution with a better value than this one. This is proving that a certain problem is infeasible. And so adding permutation, destroying symmetry is sometimes useful if you just want to find a relatively good solution, but if you really want to prove optimality, it's not the way to go. You can also replace by lexicographic minimization, so replace the cost function by powers of 2. This works for some problems, but of course you have big numerical issues. And if you have a problem with 50 variables, you cannot have a coefficient 2 to the power 50 in your objective function. So, I mean, this approach, although it's kind of, the first idea that comes to mind, it's not really a very useful way to try to deal with the symmetry. Now, I will look at just a particular case when you have your symmetry group is just the permutation of all the variables in the problem, right? So it's a complete symmetric group. One possibility is to use column generation and Danzig-Wolf decomposition. So here, just as an example, if you minimize the number of identical machines that you need to perform m tasks, you will, instead of working with the natural variable, you say, okay, I have job 1 to m, I have machines 1 to k, I will have a variable xij that tells me job I is done on machine j. Right? And of course, you have a big symmetry group between these variables because you can permute the machines. You will generate column for your problem. You just look at all the subset of tasks that can be performed on one particular machine. Right? You enumerate all these subsets, and then you ask, I want to cover all my jobs with the smallest number of these subset that I've generated. So this is Danzig-Wolf decomposition. And this was done, in particular, you have applications by Barnard, Johnson, Nemhauser in 98. This is also the approach used for edge or vertex coloring by Nemhauser, Park, Mehrotra, and Trick. So this is an approach that works. And the reason why is essentially it destroys the symmetry between the machines. Because once you generate a subset of job that can be executed on one of the machines, it can be executed on any of the machines. And then when you solve the covering problem, you don't care if this subset of job is done on machine 1, machine 2, machine 3. So in fact, you get rid of the symmetry between the machines by generating these subsets and then saying, I just need to select k of these subsets. Yes. Okay, let's look now quickly at approach number 3, adding inequalities. So here, you add inequalities to remove some of the symmetry of the problem, keeping at least one optimal solution. Right? So here, my feasible set is just this triangle. I have two variables. Of course, these two solutions, x1 equals 1, x2 equals 0, x2 equals 1, x1 equals 0, are symmetric. And if I recognize this, I can say, well, I'm interested only in the solution where x1 is greater or equals to x2. And by using this, you add this, you intersect your triangle, the gray triangle with the green triangle, and you get this new triangle, but you see that now you have vertices that are fractional that exist here. The drawback is that typically for most applications, when you can come up with a set of inequalities that you can show are valid, you don't remove completely the symmetry in the problem. Right? It can be the case that there are still symmetric solutions that exist in your problem, although you are not able to realize it. And this might create highly fractional LP relaxation, which are difficult to deal with when you solve using standard commercial solvers. Nevertheless, it's an approach that is quite useful, in particular when you have a group that is relatively small. Right? So if you have, let's say, a symmetry group between two machines, adding a constraint saying, you know, getting rid of this simple symmetry is probably a very smart way to deal with the symmetry. You don't need anything heavier. On the other hand, if you have 10 identical machines, if you start to try to add inequalities to deal with this, you will run into problems, and there might be a better way to deal with the symmetry. Nevertheless, that's an approach. Why is this an attractive possibility? Is that you just need to modify your model, and you keep using the same solver as before. So you don't have to do any work, coding, anything. You can just add a few inequalities in your model and solve it using CPLEX or whatever. And you take advantage of at least a little bit of your knowledge that there is the symmetry. And on some problem, you will see big improvements by doing that. Right, so in particular, when the group is not very large and you are smart about selecting your added inequalities, you can easily get speed up of factor 10 to 100 or even more. Right, it might make the difference between solving the problem and not solving the problem. Now, I will just mention this quickly. So when you have partitioning problem, because this is a very typical, so this is adding inequality orbitops. When you have a bunch of linear inequality, AX more equals to B, and you have assignment variable, typically job to machines, right? XIJ give you job I is done on machine J. Mm-hmm. And each job, typically you would say the sum over all the machines should be equal to 1. This job must be done on one of the machines exactly. If you collect the variable in two-dimensional matrix, right, so here you would expect the sum over each row should be, let's say, equal to 1. Of course, you can permute the column of this matrix. If you have a feasible solution, you permute the column of this matrix, you get another feasible solution. And if you assume that the starting AX equal B set of constraints also has this same set of permutation, so if any permutation of the column of X is a symmetry of the problem, you can add, next slide, so orbitop. It is known, there is a family of symmetry breaking inequality that are known. They are called shifted column inequalities. You have a polynomial time separation algorithm for these inequalities, and this describes the convexal of non-isomorphic solution of this part of the problem. So by adding, of course, you get a huge number of these inequalities, but if you were adding all these inequalities to your problem, you would get exactly the convexal of the non-isomorphic solution, which is the graal of, polyhedral combinatorics. I speak too much French recently. So you get you can use this, so Kaibel Fetch came with this collection of inequalities, and they applied it to certain problems, and this works well in practice. You have another modification you can do for graph coloring type problem. So this is asymmetric representative. So you know graph coloring, you want to color the vertices of a graph so that two adjacent vertices receive distinct colors. So what I will present here can be generalized to more general partitioning problem, but just to get you some intuition, let's look at this graph coloring problem. The symmetry you will consider is just the permutation between the colors. you ignore the fact that maybe the graph itself is symmetric. So here the idea is, of course, you can write a simple x in formulation saying node 1 receive color j, xij equal 1 if node I receives color j. Right? And you have a bunch of binary variables, and you can write an easy ILP formulation, but this is a bad formulation. This is difficult to solve. So here you will be using zij. The idea of the formulation is that each node will select another node or itself as its representative. Right, you will have this zij variable that tells you 1 if I is the representative node of j. So every node has to select 1. And the constraints that you are adding is just everybody must, so this is the continuation, next slide, the sum of the ij should be 1 over all ij that are not, so a node, I mean, all the nodes that will select the same representative will correspond to a color class in your solution. So clearly, if you are a node cannot select a representative that is adjacent to itself. It can select himself, or it can select any other node that is not adjacent to himself. So these inequalities here is just saying node I has to select exactly one representative, and he cannot select anybody that is adjacent to himself. Then this one tells you that if you have j and k that are an edge of the graph, then they cannot be both, they cannot select the same representative I. And you can select a representative I if only if node I select itself as its own representative. And so that's a formulation that works pretty well for graph coloring problems in certain applications. So these two papers are just theoretical, but in the last year there have been a couple of applications that have been using this formulation, and this works extremely well. So there are situations where if you really have to solve this type of graph coloring problem, this is a great formulation to experiment with. Okay, now if we look at the other approach, which is based on pruning the tree, so this is the slide isomorphism-free backtracking enumeration. This is something that has been done since the 60s. So this is not something that has been developed recently. So if you try to solve an ILP, let's say with binary variables, and you have A is a node of the enumeration tree, you can keep track of what variables are fixed to value 1 at this particular node, what are the variables that are fixed to 0 at this particular node. And you say that problem A and B are isomorphic if there exists a permutation in the group such that the image of FA1 is exactly FB1 and the image of FA0 is exactly FB0. Right? Because then you have a proof, these two nodes have exactly the same fixing for the variable, I can solve only one of these two. I don't need to solve both. So the first application I know in ILP of this is this paper by Bazara and Kirka in 83. But this is very heavy, right? This is not an easy problem. Deciding does there exist a permutation G in the group such that G of FA1 equals F1B, and here you have to do it both for FA1 and FA0. This is heavy. I mean, it might pay off, but this is not easy to do. So a related approach is symmetry breaking during search. So it's a constraint programming approach. You will add constraints for each created node of the tree to forbid isomorphic ones. So each time you develop a node in the tree, you will say, I can now, in the future nodes, I can always add this inequality, but because I know that if this inequality is violated, then I have something that is symmetric to what I just solved. But then you have to keep track of all the nodes that you have developed so far, and this may require, of course, a huge number of constraints. So you have all kind of experiments that were made using only a subset of the inequalities and dealing with that, but this is this is not an easy thing to implement efficiently, and in fact this works relatively well when the group is small. So if you have a group that has, let's say, a few, up to maybe 100,000 permutations, maybe this approach will work. But if you have a group with several millions of permutations and the problem is difficult, you need to develop a reasonable number of nodes before solving it, this will be probably not the solution, the method that you should select. They are implementation of this based on GAP, which is a software for doing group operations. So if we look now at the approach number 5, which is pruning, so here we assume that we branch by partitioning the domain of a variable into at least 2 subdomains, and you order the sum topological. So let's say if you just branch by saying a variable is either 0 or 1, you always put 1 on the left, always 0 on the right, or vice versa. Right? But you have a way to draw this tree. This is a graphical representation of the tree. And of course, when you do this, if you do this pruning operation, you want to define a way to prune node of the tree such that it doesn't interfere with usual operation of the branch and bound tree. So if you are using cplex, for example, for solving your problem, you want to let cplex still decide on which variable to branch. You don't want to force him. You want to keep the freedom to choose the branching variable. You want the freedom to decide how to partition the variable domain. And of course, a big thing is that you want to use information that is available only at a single node of the tree. You don't want to have to look at all the nodes that you have developed so far and make a test between every pair of nodes, for example, because if your tree becomes large, it becomes too costly. So you really want to concentrate on a single node of the tree. By just looking at what is happening here, you want to say, I can prune this node without knowing anything else about what was done in the tree. And the last one is just a technical condition that I will skip for today. So the first idea is a left of path mapping. So this is the next slide. So if you have A that is a node of the tree, you look at all the variables that are fixed to 0 at this node, all the variables that are fixed to 1 at this node, these two sets FA0 and FA1. So in this small example here, you can see that FA1 is 2, FA0 is 3, 7, right? I set 3 and 7 to 0, I set X2 equals to 1. And if I look at node B, I have set X3 equals 0 and X7 equals to 1. And now you have this property that graphically it says that if I have a node A, here my tree is always drawn. The left branch is always fixing the variable to 1. The right branch is always fixing a variable to 0. So now if I take node A and I find a permutation in my group so that I'm able to map this fixing to something that is to the left of the path joining the root to A in my tree, then I can prune A. So here there exists a permutation G. Suppose that there exists a permutation G with G of 3 equals 3 and G of 2 equals 7. So you see that G of 2 is 7, so FA1 is sent on F1B. G of 3 is 3, so FA0 covers FB0. So this means that using this permutation G, this node A is mapped to a son of B somewhere. Right, an equivalent solution exists in this subtree. And so using the rule that if I can find a permutation that sends this to the left of the path here, I can prune A, this is a valid pruning algorithm. You will always keep, right? Because here, if you decide to prune that equivalent solution, it's because there is one that is on the left of this particular path. And at some point, you will not be able to prune the leftmost solution cannot be pruned. Right, the leftmost solution corresponding to this subtree must be kept. And so this is a valid pruning algorithm. So next slide. So you have backtrack searching with symmetry, BSS, that was proposed by Braun, Finkelstein, Perdom, and symmetry breaking by dominance detection, SBDD, by Fall, Schamberger, and Selman. They are very similar to each other. I think I will. They have slightly different implementation and constraints, but essentially this is this idea of left of path mapping. The problem with this Braun-Finkelstein-Perdom approach is that they give description of the code, but they give almost no numerical results. The only numerical result I could find was for this, you probably know this queen problem, right? You want to place 8 queen on an 8x8 chessboard so that no queen attack each other. And so, you know, it's the symmetric group for this problem has size 8. So it's not, you know, a very good test. There are a better way to solve this problem than using this pruning idea for that particular problem. For SBDD, the drawback of the code that is available is that they just look at very specific application and they don't have an implementation that works with an arbitrary group. So each time they have to code a special, you know, for testing if this node can be mapped to a node that is on the left of the tree, you need a mechanism to do that. So you can do it based on the group description and you have something that will work with any group. Or you can do it manually, you know, given a certain problem, you know something about the group, and you can do this operation relatively quickly. So this is what was done in most applications using SBDD. It's a very specific algorithm for the specific group corresponding to that particular problem. They have a way to code this check for the left of path mapping. Second approach, which is the approach that I spend a lot of time on, this is the lexicomine support pruning. Superficially, it looks very similar, but it is different. And again, I don't claim that I invented this method. This was a method that was used in combinatorics for backtracking enumeration since the 60s. I just ported it to specifically ILP. And of course, I added a few developments. Because I know that I'm using ILP, I can do things that are interesting that were not developed earlier. So here, instead of, like the previous method, we're looking both at FA1 and FA0. Here, you just look at FA1. And you compare fixing at A with left sum issue from ancestor of A. So again, this is this idea of the left of path mapping. But here you just look at the variable set to 1 at node A, and you prune A if there exists a permutation in the group that is mapping a subset of FA1 to FB1. So if you want, it's the same test as the previous one, but I don't test what happens with F0. Right? I ignore which variable was set to 0. Okay, so next slide. Or in a series of paper, I presented development of this idea and results. The drawback of the presentation was that the branching scheme that I was using was fixed from the start. You had to branch first on variable x1, then on variable x2, then on variable x3. But in fact, Ostrovsky showed that you can relax this constraint, so it's not essential for the method to work. You can branch whatever whatever way you want, but that was an observation that I didn't make earlier. So you have a generated code that works with any group, and we have solved a bunch of problems that were open using this code. So I think it's something that is bringing something. Now, if you compare these techniques, this is the next slide. If you just make a bare bone comparison, you can show that. If you look at the pruning that lexicomine support is doing, you will do more. Right? You will prune more nodes than what you do if you just do left of path mapping pruning. And the algorithm based on group representation for testing if you can do this left of path mapping our backtracking algorithm with depth that depends on FA1, the cardinality of the set that you want to test. So of course, since lexicomin support pruning just look at FA1 and forgets about FA0, you get an algorithm that is faster. And in particular, when you have problem in combinatorics, usually, you know, you have maybe 200 variables. In the optimal solution, you will have just 20 of them set to a positive value. And you will have all the other ones set to zero. So here, it's a big advantage to be able to do a backtracking search that depends only on the variable set to 1 instead of dealing also with the variable set to 0. So if you just look at this bare-bone comparison, you will say this is lexicomin is much faster, it prunes more, it wins hands-on. However, I mean, you can do variable fixing. So when you are sitting at a node of the tree, by just looking at the problem, you can conclude, okay, this variable can be set to zero, for example. So if you do that cleverly, so if there exists a subset in FA1 such that you have F that is a subset of variables set to 1, B is a left ancestor of A, and there exists a permutation with G of F equals FB1, then you can set to zero all the variable in the inverse of FP0. I mean, you can show this is true, and you call this a zero setting. So this is just a simple operation that, looking at the problem, you are able to conclude this variable can be set to zero. So if you do this, if you do a full zero setting, so you are not forgetting any of these variables, then you can show that, in fact, the pruning that you do in both cases will be exactly the same. You will get exactly the same tree. More variables are set to zero by left-of-path mapping than with lexicomin support. But, of course, for deep trees, the left-of-path mapping checking for left-of-path is much slower than for lexicomin. I think I will skip these last comments. Do I have
another 3 minutes?
3 minutes. Okay. Well, there are two other approaches that have been used. Orbital branching is just recompute the symmetry group at each node. Right? It could happen that you have a problem that has few symmetries, but when you start fixing variables, suddenly you get a huge symmetry group that appears. There are applications like this. So it could pay off that at some point in the tree, you look at the current problem and recompute what is the symmetry group of this problem and use that symmetry group in the subtree. And orbital branching, so you recompute the symmetry group for the free variables that are not fixed to 1 or 0. You could compute the partition of free variable into orbits given this symmetry group. And you select one orbit and one variable in this orbit. And the way you branch is to say either all the variables in this orbit, right? An orbit is a bunch of variables that are equivalent in this problem. So you're saying either all the variables in this set should be set to zero, or at least one will be set to zero. And then you pick this xi to say if one of these variables is set to one, then it will be xi. And so this is a valid branching. Either everybody is set to zero, or xi is set to 1. And they had a good performance result on a certain number of problems using this relatively simple ID. Of course, the big problem here is recomputing the symmetry group at each node. Okay, I will skip this. So approach 7 is dominance relation. So you can use also mixed integer programming to detect assignment of variables that are dominated. But there were relatively limited efficiency observed for highly symmetric problems. It helps in certain cases, but when you have massive symmetry in the problem, using this dominance relation is not something that is strong enough to make a big difference. And that's about what I wanted to talk about today.
Thank you very much.